Well, if you could pick one moment in history and have a secret camera, this might have been an interesting one. Watching the leader of the free world in a hotel room practicing. Ich bin ein Berliner. Ich bin ein Berliner. No, ich bin ein... Until he got one of the signature phrases of his presidency right. John F. Kennedy had a joke that people who thought the presidency was the toughest job in the world had never flown on Air Force One. Kennedy's Boeing 707 could go 500 miles an hour and get to Europe in 6 hours. This changed world diplomacy in a way. In summer 1963, he aimed to use this powerful diplomatic weapon to stand up to Khrushchev by visiting West Germany, with a special visit right to the heart of the superpower confrontation at that time, the divided city of Berlin. However, despite outward appearances, standing up to the Soviets was only a small portion of the reason behind his visit and what would become his signature speech. The true reason was to repair possible break in the front against the Soviet Union among the Allies. Benjamin Gerber writes, I wonder about the history of the presidential foreign visit. Who was the first president to make a trip to another country? Who was the first president to really incorporate travel into his foreign policy agenda? Well, this trip for Kennedy was important. The French under Charles de Gaulle were developing a policy vis-a-vis the Russians without the U.S. They sought to acquire their own nuclear weapons and have their own relations. France was lost. De Gaulle said he didn't want Kennedy to visit him. But the important thing was to make sure Germany didn't follow. So first, Kennedy visited Bonn, West Germany, and told people there that the security of West Germany was important to the U.S. Crowds loved it. Then he flew over to occupied East Germany and into West Berlin. He had a speech prepared, highlighting the history of U.S.-Berlin relations, the airlift, the history of the support for West Berlin. Kennedy wasn't happy with it, though. He showed it to the commander of U.S. forces in Berlin. Mr. President, that's terrible, General James Polk told him. Kennedy agreed, and he thought of better words in his head, including one line that was in the speech before that he had practiced a bit. Ich bin ein Berliner. I am a citizen of Berlin, which, as Kennedy did not speak German, he memorized phonetically. For hours, Kennedy visited Berlin, crowds 4 deep on the sidewalk, and then 2 to 3 million came out when he spoke in front of the Berlin City Hall and made that speech. The crowd loved it so much so that the Prime Minister of Germany thought Kennedy could become the leader of his country. His national security people, though, thought it was terrible. They wanted a speech that reached out to Khrushchev, as there was talk of an arms deal. So that speech that you see in almost every history of Kennedy actually was a bit of a mistake, or he went a bit overboard and had to do some correction. Because by saying, we will stand with the people of Berlin no matter what, kind of limiting himself in terms of arms talk, so... Still, it provided a real purpose, and there was no way there would be popular support in Germany for a more nationalistic foreign policy without the U.S. after that Kennedy visit. So that was a really important, and it was the use of the president's physical presence to help. It could only happen in the 20th or 21st century. That's really when the president's physical body became an international tool. It wouldn't have been in the 18th century. Not only would it have not been practical to float George Washington over to France so he could lend his influence to the more moderate forces in the French Revolution, perhaps help his buddy Lafayette. He was sympathetic to him, of course, but just wouldn't have done that. His philosophy was no foreign entanglements, and many presidents followed his lead after that. You have to go to the 20th century to Theodore Roosevelt to get a president who left during his term. Woodrow Wilson went to Paris after World War I. And that's probably the first official use of a presidential visit, though Teddy Roosevelt did visit Panama. It was an American project in the Canal Zone at the time, but he did visit. Kennedy's speech is remembered, I think, in terms of pure impact from one visit. Nixon's visit to China probably tops the list. Goes a long way to ending the Cold War by putting multiple pressures on the Soviets. So during the 1876 Republican convention, the New York delegation was sitting down having dinner when they learned that since in Ohio, Rutherford B. Hayes was going to be named for the presidential spot on the ticket, New York would get the choice for vice president. Yeah, That was almost as exciting as whether they should order the shellfish chateau or the cream spinach with their dinner. None of the New Yorkers rushed to offer anyone to take the second spot. Finally, somebody said, "What about Wheeler?" Everybody laughed, including William Almon Wheeler, an obscure congressman from a town on the Canadian border. The next day, he was nominated by the convention. Then he became vice president. Governor Rutherford B. Hayes wrote his wife Lucy upon hearing who his number two would be and said, "I'm afraid to say, who is Wheeler?" For the next 4 years, if anything had happened to Hayes, Wheeler would become president. David Snipes writes, about vice presidents, who would be your choice, your top five of vice presidents who did not get the big chair? Okay, that's a good one. I don't know if I have five. There's not a lot of talent in some of those number two spots in the tickets, especially in the 19th century. I think Wheeler is someone who would have been interesting because the guy had a reputation for integrity and he had guts. Corruption was an issue in 1876, and thus Wheeler stood out because when Congress voted for a large pay raise, the so-called salary grab of 1873, and made it retroactive for 5 years, absolutely corrupt, Wheeler not only voted against the raise, but he returned his salary adjustment to the Treasury Department. He also stood up to the political bosses of his time. At one point, New York political boss Roscoe Conkling offered to make Wheeler Speaker of the New York Assembly. Wheeler, he said, "If you will act with us, there is nothing in the gift of the state of New York to which you may not reasonably aspire." Wheeler declined, saying, "Mr. Conkling, there is nothing in the gift of the state of New York which will compensate me for the forfeiture of my self-respect." Wheeler actually provided Hayes with advice about appointments, recommending that selections be made according to personal character, recognized capacity, and experience. When there's no help, tell the man so. He will be disappointed at the time, but it's the best way. Hayes observed that Wheeler was right, writing back, "Prompt and square talk is in the long run safest." Wheeler didn't like the second man job. "You know I did not want the place," he told a friend. He described the vice presidency as being laid away. Now, I don't fault him for this. So many vice presidents have said the same thing. But had something happened to Hayes, I think you would have got a straight shooter who would have made a good mark on the office. One of the most successful VPs to take over after the death of a president was Lyndon Johnson. His whole presidency would see some problems. But in the first few years, almost everyone agrees he managed to pass more significant legislation than the president he replaced. So if you like that, Charles Curtis is your man. He was a senator and also the majority leader of the Senate when he was tapped by Herbert Hoover and the GOP party. Haim said of him, "Mr. Curtis rarely speaks. It is in the party caucuses, in the committee rooms, in the cloakrooms that he patches up troubles, puts through legislation. His friends are many. His personality vexes few." There's another reason I singled out Curtis. I think it would have been interesting because he would have been the first president with significant Native American ancestry. His great-grandmother was a daughter of a Kaw chief who married a Frenchman in St. Louis. But Curtis also grew up on a Kaw reservation. And it might have been interesting to have a president who had that experience and who was more attuned to the life of Native Americans. Overall, I must say, I don't think vice presidents of the United States history are the best talent pool for potential presidents. These are just two people I think might have been interesting. If you want more, I would say George Clinton, vice president under Jefferson and Madison, with 21 years experience as New York governor, sure he could have handled the job. And Alvin Barkley, charming guy, Truman's VP, energetic for his age, had his own TV show, also a majority leader of the Senate. Alvin Barkley first entered the House as a bright-eyed 36-year-old member from Kentucky in 1913, 100 years ago. That Congress was special, but not for a reason that we would all celebrate. This year marks the anniversary of the 63rd Congress. They first sat in 1913. This was the first Congress to be capped at 435 members, and we've never added more to that body. Emmett O'Connell writes on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics site, "Since it's been about 100 years since we've added new House seats, it might be worth looking into why we stopped and any impact it's had." Thanks, Emmett. Glad to. I mean, in terms of the House members, I think we have a real lack of connection to our members of the House in the United States outside of the real political activists. And it's a gap that enables parties to move in and limits the amount of independence that congressmen can have because they're not people that we know independent of their party. And we vote for them because they're a party member that we like in most cases, and there certainly are exceptions. Given 300 millions of people, I don't think 435 House seats will do. That's my opinion. It was capped indeed 100 years ago. Population then was 95 million. It probably wasn't even fair then at 235,000 people per representative. In fact, it probably wasn't all that fair when Congress first convened. I mean, this isn't a mistake. There was definitely a feeling going all the way back to the construction of the Constitution that federal representatives should not be as plentiful as state representatives, should not be as close to the people as state representatives are. They wanted a bit of a better person for the federal seats than for the state seats. So that's one of the reasons we have the system that we do. I apply history to understand politics. It doesn't mean that everything historical is right and everything modern is wrong. I think we can make reforms, and this is one that I really think is a no-brainer. Why was it done? Well, you're talking about 1913. Office space and space in the chamber has a lot to do with it. By the turn of the century, office space in Washington had become a problem. Chairmen of committees had rooms assigned to them. Other members had to go to boarding houses or cheap rooms to conduct their business. In 1907, the House office building was constructed. But then this actually added to Ward's wanting to limit the members of Congress, because if you do construct a building and now you give each member an office, that's good, but you're limiting how many offices you can give out unless you construct yet another building. So something else is occurring in terms of the architecture. It is at this time that you had that semicircle of seats that make up the House of Representatives that we know today, and they took out the desks. They also had very wide aisles so members could walk through easily. There were 450 chairs set up, so it kind of made for that limit. I think these kind of spatial architectural issues were important in 1912, maybe even important in 1950 and 1965. But now, with the internet and ways to cast votes, I do wonder if we should continue at 435, because as you start to get districts with 600, 700, 800, 1 million people, how can one person really represent that? Since Christmas, there's been a lot of attention on Congress because of the fiscal cliff, which was just recently resolved in the Senate and then in the House. I'll mention this scene. A Congress and a president divided, and in the pages of the Christian Science Monitor, the president's spokesman says, "Budget negotiators are close, but taxes are the sticking point. Party in power in Congress," he said, "feel that by moving to a compromise, they'll be helping the president, helping to pull his bacon out of the fire." And an anonymous source from the other side, the Congress, brought its viewpoint. "Despite the president's talk of being willing to go the extra mile to achieve a compromise, he is instead holding fast to his original position." Another White House source. "My sense is that the forces within this country will come down so hard on both the president and Congress if they do not compromise that it will bring about one. I think the industries across this country, the savings and loans, the commercial banks, housing, those really hurting, will bring unheralded pressure on the Congress and the president to come up with a compromise. The budget deficit must be reduced." So all of this is not from 2012, though it could be. It's from 1982. Ronald Reagan is president. Democrats control the Congress. Submitta Hudson writes, "I think your end of the year podcast should talk about all the fiscal cliffs. JP Morgan bailing us out. How many times has this country been on the fiscal brink, Bruce? Starting with our loans from Holland." Well, thanks, Submitta. I never did make the end of the year. Reagan agreed to give a little on defense cuts, but he also wanted Medicare cuts. Democrats wanted the president to give in on tax cuts that had been implemented the year before. The president refused. Both sides had pressure from the business community and those who wanted to see lower interest rates, less deficit. When David Stockman, the budget director for the Reagan administration, spoke to Wall Street executives and said they'd have to wait till 1985 to see the deficit reduced, he was booed. Keep in mind, this is a time when interest rates were 13%. A coalition of moderate Republicans and enough of the conservative Democrats in Congress passed a budget that held the fiscal 1983 deficit to $103.9 billion. The budget called for $21 billion in new taxes. They didn't specify what those taxes would be to close the spending gap. Why did everyone vote for it? One congressman said, "Not because it was a good budget, but because it was the only budget." A funny story about the passage of that bill. Congress was a different place. It was all mixed up among the parties. The budget was passed because it got great support from Democrat conservatives known as boll weevils. They were needed to offset the defection of 32 Republicans, including members called Yellow Jackets, conservatives, and liberal GOP members called Gypsy Moss, who didn't like the spending cuts. One top White House aide, flying back from Europe with the president, joked, "What the whole congressional process needs is a good dose of insecticide." I keep those sources anonymous, but I'm thinking Jim Baker. Gotta be. Here's some letters to the editor to Time Magazine, 1982. Great to read these. You tell me if it sounds different than today. "Why all the fuss about the budget farce?" one writer writes. "Congress has no legal obligation to pay attention to the budget it adopts. This is why we have a $1 trillion national debt, and that we'll waste nearly $100 billion this year just to pay the interest." Here's another letter writer. "The rise in the power of the political action committees is alarming. The result is a breakdown of the democratic process in which rich minorities buy votes and elections with total disregard for the rest of America." Another letter writer. "With an almost messianic faith in his budget, the president's becoming intransigent. On the other hand, if Congress is simply unable to act decisively, its members shouldn't be approaching the electorate for a further vote in confidence. President and Congress are only playing lip service to our economic woes." All of that from 1982 could have been in a newspaper today. So I don't see much difference about the fiscal cliff than many common financial battles between a president and a Congress of different parties, which are followed by a compromise. Except that this one featured those triggers, the self-inflicted severe budget cut, sequestration, if they didn't deal. Now, for that reason, I was pretty aware that there would be some kind of deal. This didn't surprise me at all. Doubling the price of milk, canceling unemployment benefits, massive cuts to doctors who have Medicare patients, probably going to lead them to not take more patients, huge defense cuts, wasn't going to happen. I was pretty sure a deal was going to come. Overall, I think that for a second-term president, it's good from President Obama's point of view that it was resolved, because second-term presidents are known to have trouble and are historically predestined to take a bath in the six-year midterms. 2013, you can think of this as like the oxygen bubble for getting anything done. Got to get it done now. He has had any accomplishments in his second term. No, he's got big plans. Now, at the same time, Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, trolled by the GOP party, gains a little because, in my opinion, no one was in favor of going over that cliff, 1982 or 2012. Even though an odd coalition of Tea Party voices and ultra-liberals were saying, "Oh, just go ahead, the cliff doesn't matter," most Americans didn't agree with that. So you're John Boehner, you're Mitch McConnell here. You can take a loss in 2013. In fact, you can take a couple, because the real battle is going to be in 2014. The fiscal cliff involved the extension of tax cuts that George W. Bush passed. That raises a question. How much of what President Obama is doing can be blamed on or credited to what George W. Bush did? How much does any president benefit from their predecessor? Ward Batty writes, the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics site enjoyed the conversation about second-term presidents. This one's from a little while ago. "I think it's possible that the good start that Reagan got off to was at least in part due to policies from the Carter administration, mostly on lowering interest rates. But the first budget for every new administration is mostly the one created by the preceding administration." Which presidents do you think were most helped by the preceding administration? Good question. I do think all presidencies interlock, but in an odd way, I think both sides would agree that Carter helped Reagan, but for different reasons, right? Because on one hand, you can say, oh, Carter was a long-term thinker. You know, he made the Volcker appointment. He took some drastic actions on rates. That's one way to say that Carter helped Reagan by what he did. On the other hand, because Carter's performance was not seen as very good, particularly his relations with Congress and his ability to get anything done legislatively, Reagan could only improve and look better. Tip O'Neill pined for a president who could perform like Reagan, though he wanted someone of his own party. "If Jimmy Carter came to town with Reagan's luster and some of his staff, what we could have done," O'Neill said in his memoir. In terms of interest rates, it's hard to assign blame or praise to presidents over those. interest rates were awfully bad in the 1970s. Carter took the brunt of it. He was elected when rates were 6.5. After a year, went up to 8, then 11 in his third year, and 18% in his fourth. Carter went after credit card spending. Inflation, he said, is fed by credit finance spending. Consumers have gone into debt too heavily. Businesses and other borrowers are tempted to finance speculative ventures. Using powers granted by Congress in 1969, President authorized the Federal Reserve Board to control unsecured consumer borrowing, essentially assessing a penalty for extended credit lines over a certain amount. In this, he had a cooperative Federal Reserve chair. Now, the Federal Reserve does not report to the president, but the president appoints him, and in this case, they were a bit of lockstep on this. Paul Volcker wanted to restrain interest rates. He began a voluntary program restraining excessive growth in loans by larger banks. At the same time, Carter made spending reductions, though they were about 2% of the budget. So with interest rates, let's look at how much he helped Reagan, right? Carter loses, and then the interest rate magically goes down because Reagan came to office. It didn't actually work that way. It did go down, but it took some time. Really, it took so long that it's hard to assign credit or blame here. It's still 18% in October 1981. That's Reagan's first year well into it. 16% in 1982. This is Reagan's second year. 12% 1983. Down to 11 his election year. It's 10% by the end of his presidency. Really comes down in George H.W. Bush's administration. Now, of course, the 3.25%. Carter had promised to end the deficit when he won his election. And he didn't do that, but he did leave a nice budget that left the deficit pretty low. However, some of his revenue estimates, for example, $13 billion from proposed 10-cent per gallon tax on gasoline, was unrealistic. Congress made it clear they weren't going to pass a tax on gas like that. Carter also said that he would lower pay raises for federal employees in October to 5.5%. The previous year, he had raised it 9.1%, so even after promising to lower it to 7%. So now he's making an unrealistic promise for a future president. He doesn't have to bear the burden of actually implementing it. So David Stockman, Reagan's budget chief, looked at that 1981 budget. This is that budget you referenced that the president gives to the incoming president and said the relatively low deficit is entirely cosmetic and artificial. And of course, Stockman and the Reagan team crafted their own budget. Could you imagine now these states going for these parties? California ceded to the Republican candidate, with Democrats basically saying they don't have much chance of winning, while the Democrats nominate a New Yorker for vice president, a desperate play to maybe win the state. It seems like another world, but it's only 1984. Michael Rancer writes, I heard your podcast yesterday in the Electoral College, as always interesting and informative. However, I have to take issue with your implied assessment that successful candidates for the presidency need to and generally do win with what you call the spotted electoral map rather than using a regional strategy. If you look at the states Obama won, they were clustered almost exclusively in two regional groupings, one covering the Northeast down to Potomac River and around the Great Lakes, the other on the West Coast. The only exceptions were New Mexico, Colorado, and Florida, and theoretically, Obama could have won without them. Romney's support, in contrast, was geographically concentrated in the Southeast, Great Plains, Rocky Mountain states. The country is, in fact, becoming more geopolitically segregated than it has in many decades. Well, I mean, I agree with the point, and definitely geography plays a big role in politics, and definitely as the example I gave in 1984 there, things have changed. I think it's a different point than what was raised in the cast. The reference to a spotted electoral map there simply means you've got to have states in more than one area of the country to win. Yeah. So it's spotted perhaps from a greater distance than what you're thinking. The Electoral College means that you can't ignore regions. So I think winning candidates, even if they're in geographic clusters, need to attempt to win states from all over the country in order to win. It does not ensure absolute geographic balance, the Electoral College. It reduces a complete imbalance, which theoretically could occur in a popular vote contest, or at least could have in history. I gave some extreme examples, like Carter winning everything east and nothing west. So even the Electoral College is not perfect here, but Usually, you have to win all over the country to win. At the same time, there'll be gaps of the opposite color as well on that electoral map. So really think we're talking about two different things. So with Obama, he could have done without Florida, perhaps, although it was certainly a safety margin and good to have, couldn't have done it without Virginia then. And so I think that you had to make a reasonable attempt at one southern state in order to win that election. The East Coast and West, the Midwest, different regions of the country, he got strength. It is true, however, that the country is a bit more geographically split politically. 1984 provides that example. Reagan was probably going to win California. And in addition to the idea of appealing to women voters, Mondale was sure to choose a New Yorker as his candidate, because at least Democrats then had a chance there. Indeed, 1984 would be the last time Republicans would win New York. A more partisan politics, perhaps. Less shades of different types of philosophy within the parties. Candidates for president and congressional candidates. So I agree that there's a regional division. I think a slightly different point than raising that Electoral College cast, that the Electoral College has a benefit, one of the benefits being, whether you like it or not, that it tends to enforce regional diversity. So a candidate like John Kerry can win the entire Northeast, but absent winning, one southern state or Iowa, not getting in the White House. Well, here's someone who didn't get in the White House either. President Cleveland, President McKinley, President Long? Well, it might have happened because the former governor of Massachusetts was one of the people in consideration for the vice presidential nomination in 1900. Actually, as the Secretary of the Navy, he was Theodore Roosevelt's boss. But because of a series of events and a bit of a story around it, President Long never happened, and his subordinate, Roosevelt, would become president. Brett Miller writes, what was the reason that McKinley needed Theodore Roosevelt on the ticket in 1900? Well, I understand his former VP died. Had they no inkling of what they were getting? Was T.R. a good soldier? Did he stay on message through that 1900 election? Obviously, when T.R. became president, Big Business must have thought they had a Trojan horse on their hands. Well, yes, Garrett Hobart, the vice president of the McKinley, had died. They needed a new running mate. Roosevelt was elected New York governor at this time, coming back from the strength of his Spanish-American War exploits, the coverage in the newspapers. He was one of the Rough Riders. Governor Roosevelt quarreled constantly with New York State Republican political boss Thomas Platt. Didn't take long for these two to have a rift. In a letter to one of his friends in April of 1900, Theodore Roosevelt wondered about some of these questions out loud. Nobody can tell, and least of all the machine itself, whether the machine intends to renominate me next fall or not. If for some reason I shall be weak, whether on account of faults or virtues, nobody can tell, and least of all the machine itself, whether the machine intends to renominate me next fall or not. If for some reason I shall be weak, whether on the account of my faults or virtues, doubtless the machine will throw me over. They would feel no acute grief at doing so. The big corporations undoubtedly want to beat me. Later he told his friend Albert Shaw from the Review of Reviews. They would like to get me out of politics for good, but at the moment they think the best thing they can do is put me in the vice presidency. I was kind of aware of what was going on here. That boss Thomas Platt wanted to ease him out of the governorship by making him vice president. Now Mark Hanna, who was running the McKinley campaign, hated the idea. He said, "Do you realize there is one life between that madman and the presidency?" But there was more than him just loudly complaining about it. When there's momentum for Governor Roosevelt on the vice presidential ticket started to build, Hanna actually went up to Roosevelt's suite and told him, "Your boom has nothing to do with popularity. Platt is just using you. If you had honor, you'd withdraw." See, but Roosevelt had opposite pressures. How could he refuse such a thing if the convention demanded it? This might be his big chance. It's a chance at national attention, even though it's the number two spot. Now, there were many that told him he should sign a statement that says he had no interest in the vice presidency and they'd pick someone else, maybe John Long. He didn't sign it. He didn't refuse. He didn't listen to Hanna, and history was made. Theodore Roosevelt was indeed a good soldier in that campaign. He wasn't making any super progressive statements, certainly nothing of the type that you would hear in 1912. He was the counter to Bryan, because once again, McKinley was facing William Jennings Bryan. Bryan was out there speaking. Once again, McKinley's on his front porch. But this time in 1900, you had a secret weapon on the Republican side. Theodore Roosevelt was going out, just like Bryan, on trains and making some terrific speeches. So I think in 1900, the GOP party was pleased at least with that campaign. They took their chances, those big corporations that were backing Republicans at the time or backing Hanna, took their chances that he wasn't going to become president. Then he did. Even in 1904, many of those corporations, big businesses, ended up supporting Roosevelt, even though he would go on in his second term to prosecute a few of them. Well, this is the first Hodgepodge cast of 2013. I hope you enjoyed it. Not everything we talked about today relates to current politics. Some of it does. Some of it is just interesting and fun, and that's important too. Want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. There I have a link to a Facebook site where you can comment on things. Also have the archive available, $25.99. We have hours and hours of podcasts, almost everything that I've recorded for 6 years, a lot of different topics. And if you like the program, please tell someone about it. Thanks for listening.